thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Art of the Score. Tonight, Movie Geeks United co-host Dean Treadway interviews George S. Clinton. In his impressive resume, Mr. Clinton has shown time and time again an unrivaled versatility in the world of film composition. From cult hits like Golden Globus's The Apple or Cheech and Chong's Still Smokin', to blockbusters like Austin Powers and Mortal Kombat, to his haunting work for the HBO film Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. We discuss all of these projects and a lot more during this revealing conversation, as well as an upcoming event, the first annual Southeast Film Symposium, March 1st through the 3rd, held in Chattanooga, Tennessee, for which Mr. Clinton will serve as the artistic advisor. During the event, participants will receive a behind-the-scenes look into film scoring through a series of panels and discussions, and Mr. Clinton will conduct the Chattanooga Symphony for a performance of his Austin Powers suite as part of the Hooray for Hollywood event, which will also include works by Max Steiner and John Williams.
Are there elements of being from the South that have found their way into all of your music for movies and even on stage and so forth?
You know, yes. The short answer to that is yes. I in Chattanooga, my mother was an organist at the Southern Baptist Church there, so I was singing from the time I could stand up. And as you know, Southern Baptist Church music is very beautiful and emotional. And so that became part of my musical influence, along with the rock bands I played in high school. And then when I worked my way through college at Middle Tennessee State University, I was doing session work and writing songs in Nashville before I made my way out to California. So I had a lot of musical influences in Chattanooga, you know, everything from hymns to bar tunes. And then when I got out to California, I was still playing rock and roll and still writing songs. And R&B had also been a big part of what I was doing in Chattanooga. I was in a band that was an R&B band. And I found myself writing a lot of R&B tunes for Warner Brothers Music. And being, you know, some of them being recorded by Michael Jackson and by Joe Cocker and people like that. And when Cheech and Chong saw my band playing at a club there, they asked me if I wanted to do music for a movie they were doing. And I, of course, said yes, and that was 32 years ago.
I want to ask you about this. I have to, you know. I know that a big formative experience for you happened at in 1969 at the Atlanta Pop Festival, which was, I think, really even more well-attended than Woodstock, maybe. I mean, it was huge. The guest list was huge, right? I mean, Janis Joplin and Creedence Clearwater and Led Zeppelin, Dave Brubeck, Chicago. What was it about the one artist I know that you saw at that event that really inspired you to move to Los Angeles to pursue songwriting as a profession?
Well, I had just graduated from college and, you know, didn't exactly know what I wanted to do, so I decided to go to the Atlanta Pop Festival, which, as you said, you know, was even bigger than Woodstock. In fact, occurred before Woodstock, you know, just before it. And a lot of the same bands who were at Woodstock actually played at the Atlanta Pop Festival first. So, you know, I was a young hippie kind of fella and went down there and just really, really got into the experience of being at that festival. There was an amazing, I don't know how to describe it. It was like Woodstock in that way, you know, this feeling of real community and belonging to this generation. I guess that I had partied a little too hardy, but all I remember is as Joe Cocker was singing with a little help from my friends, I was clinging to the ground so I didn't get thrown off the earth by centrifugal force.
That's great. And he was up there with the Grease Band. He was up there with the Grease Band, right? With Bruce Hampton's first band. You know, Colonel Bruce is a friend of mine, you know. So.
Is that right? Well, that's Nicky Hopkins and all those people, you know, were playing with him then. And I tell you, that felt like I had gone to church. So I took that as an epiphany, and the next weekend I was on an airplane for Los Angeles.
When you got to L.A., how long did it take you before you were writing songs that were being recorded and played and so forth? You know?
Well, I formed a band with another Tennessean once I got there named Wayne Berry, and we formed a band called Timber. And for the first 2 or 3 years I was there, that we recorded a couple of albums and, you know, played around up and down the West Coast, and had a pretty good run. And it was during that time that one of the fellows from Warner Brothers Music heard some of my songs and asked me if I'd ever be interested in doing some writing for other people. And so once the band broke up, I decided it might be an interesting thing to do. So they hired me as a staff writer, and for about 8 years, that's pretty much what I did.
Yeah. Now, I understand, I have to ask you this. I understand your first and only hit, and I've listened to it online on YouTube, and it's great. And it was a hit in the UK with a song called Please Don't Run From Me. Classic of Northern Soul in Britain, but it has an unusual history, right? So can you tell us a little bit about the history there?
Well, yes, I can. They did not include a picture with this record when they sent it over, and the soul stations over there, the black dance clubs, because it was, my band was called the George Clinton Band, all figured that it was funkadelic, and so they started playing this, and people just really liked it, and so it was sort of a hit, but it's almost an accidental hit.
You can still go on YouTube and listen to Please Don't Run For Me, and there's still some inclusions of it there that picture George Clinton, George Clinton from P-Funk.
I know.
I think it's hilarious. And it's an easy mistake to make and so forth. So,
I know, it is. It really is.
So what are you going to say? You're lumped in with that person, for a long time by virtue of your names. Now, let me ask you this. So now we're going to get into the movies here. And I'm starting in 1980, and I would be remiss if I did not ask you about working on one of my favorite cult movies, The Apple, the big, silly, Golden Globus cult movie from 1980.
Uh-huh.
Tell me, and I love this movie, I just adore it, it's essential viewing, I think, for anybody who is into cult movies, and uh-huh. I really dig it for a lot
thanks
of the reasons.
Much.
I dig it. I really do. I think it's amazing. What was your? Can you describe what your role in working on that film was? I know you were the co-lyricist, which is amazing too, and you were the music supervisor and orchestrator. Do you have any specific memories of that? Incredibly wild production.
Very much so. The director was an Israeli director named Menachem Golan, and he was sort of known for being kind of a little bit mishugana, as they say, a little bit crazy. And so he had seen this stage musical in Israel called Atapua, which was The Apple, and he had brought the fellow Kobe Recht and his wife Iris over to Hollywood to make a movie out of this musical. And they wanted to find somebody who could help Americanize the songs and the music too. And mm-hmm. so a friend of mine worked for him and suggested me, and I went over and I met with them, and we really hit it off. And so for the next year, I was working on this crazy musical about the future, and wound up going to London and getting to conduct the London Philharmonic Orchestra for part of the score. I'm actually in the movie three different times.
At three different characters, really?
Yeah, three different characters. You have to look fast, but you'll see me. I'm the hunchback of Notre Dame in the hell scene, who hands the apple to the lead actor.
Oh. And I might have a picture of that on my website.
You might very well have it. Anyway, so it was quite an experience, and you know, we recorded the music in London and shot the movie in Berlin, and then came back to Los Angeles, and it was a huge flop.
To the ropes of the fantasies and hopes we are dangling.
Mr. Boogaloo!
He's so eager to believe, and so easily deceived. Like a baby watching magic, he's so gullible, it's tragic in the world of naive.
Life is nothing but tremendous. In 1994, we fight for the spotlight.
Actually a club in Los Angeles called the Bad Movie Club, and mm-hmm. every now and then it shows it at midnight because it's one of those bad movies that people really love, and so it's almost like the Rocky Horror Show. So the people who really know it show up and sing along with the music, and
it should be like on the level of Rocky Horror, I think. And you know, it just recently played at Walter Reed Cinema in New York City when they were doing a Golden Globus retrospective. So, you know, I mean, so there's nothing to be ashamed of there. It's amazing. Now I want to move on to Cheech and Chong, who of all people really helped guide you further into the film world. What was your first meeting with them like, and how did that transition go from being, you know, being a rock artist and even a jazz artist to being a composer of movie music?
Well, like I said, you know, I had a band, and as it turned out, this guy that was their film producer lived across the street from this house that I was renting the basement of. And we had seen each other, you know, on the street and everything, and eventually asked me what I did, and I told him, and I gave him one of my records. And he said, "Hey, I want to bring somebody down to your gig." We were playing at a club there, and I said, "Great!" And so, as it turned out, it was Cheech and Chong, and they came backstage, and you know, they liked my music, and they came back stage afterwards and said, "Hey, you know, you want to do some music for our movie?" And I said, "Sure." And I had never done film music before, but I figured it was Cheech and Chong, so I messed up. You know, they might not have even noticed, but anyway, as it turned out, I was able to take some extension courses at UCLA in film scoring. I have a degree in music that I got at MTSU, so I already knew how to write for orchestra, and that's how I started scoring movies. And it's funny, the first one I did was called Still Smoking, and then that next summer I get a call from Chong. "Hey, Clinton, it's Chong. We're in Paris. You know, Orion Pictures has rented us a chateau. And we're doing this movie called The Corsican Brothers. What are you doing? I'm just hanging. He said, well, come on over, man. You can do the music. So they sent me a plane ticket, and I spent the summer of 1983 or two in outside Paris with Cheech and Chong doing this crazy Corsican Brothers movie.
Well, I'm sure this is something that you could have not possibly expected in 1969.
No, exactly.
Now I'm going to get deeper into your career. I've noticed that with your scores to movies like John McNaughton's Wild Things and 3,000 Miles to Graceland and Del Shore's Sordid Lives, which is extremely a very extremely Southern movie, as well as many others, your style is both chameleon like, but yet it always speaks to your roots as a rocker and as a jazz performer, even as a jazz performer. You know, what kind of qualities do you think that your stage and recording experience has lent to your film music? You know, there are not many people who've had your career trajectory.
I think that there is you're right, there is a rock and roll sensibility to my approach, even if it's an orchestra. Not that it's always loud and fast, but there is a kind of a visceral or an instinctive thing I try to get into when I'm writing for a movie. So that I'm not, it doesn't come from my head or from my intellect, but it comes from, you know, either my heart or my gut or whatever. And I think that's the way the rock and roll is, too. I think that, you know, it's not a cerebral music. And so I think that that's what is evident, I hope, in my film music. It's not necessarily a cerebral kind of music, that it's somehow connected to the emotion of the film and, you know, the visceral parts of the movie.
I definitely get that. Can I ask you, it took me a little while to, like, really recognize your scores, you know, immediately before I even saw your name on the screen. And then there was a point where I said, is this a George S. Clinton score? And then it was, you know. And so I recognized your work, you know, immediately. But that's not to say that it's the same every time, you know. It changes all the time with orchestral scores and even things like, you know, The Boys Next Door, you know, which you did with Penelope Spheeris, you know. That was something very different, you know. So has a director ever given you a challenge that stumped you? Because I just don't think, you know, my personal opinion is I don't think that you could be stumped.
Well, you know what? It's been a challenge, and sometimes the first direction you go is not the direction that the director wants right away. And a good director is willing to let you find, it's like the way they direct an actor. You know, they don't give them word for word how they're supposed to play their part. A good director lets that actor bring his own talent to the role. And I think it's the same thing when they work with a composer. You have to let, even if it's not right the first time, you have to give them enough direction and enough freedom to come back with something, you know, that will be. And, you know, you wind up doing individual pieces of music within a film sometimes three or four times before you get it right, or before you get it to the place where the director wants it. So you know, that's the challenge. The other thing that I try to do is to let the movie sort of tell me the kind of music that it needs, you know, rather than superimposing a concept on it right off the bat. I really try to live with the movie and talk with the director and then, you know, start hearing things that I think that'll fit.
Right. I mean, I noticed that, you know, with things like the Red Shoe Diaries series.
Yeah.
And of course, with the Mortal Kombat series, you know, which I think are both pretty popular. With the latter, you know, with Mortal Kombat, it's fascinating that you took elements of Asian music and heavy metal and then orchestral music and fused them together. How much inspiration was taken from the original video game and for that project,
what is
for
it?
The Mortal Kombat project?
Interesting story about that. When they hired me to do the score originally, they thought it was just going to be a straight-up orchestral action score. And so they have these things called the test market screenings where they'll invite an audience to come and see an unfinished version of the film. You know, it's been edited together, but none of the final visual effects are in and none of the real music is in. So they'll put what they call temporary music or a temp score under the film to show it to an audience to kind of get a feeling for whether or not, you know, the film is working. So anyway, the place that they did this test marketing in L.A. was in a very kind of rough part of town, and I knew it was going to be a very special screening because I was sitting on the aisle, and I heard this usher come up and whisper to the manager, "There's a guy in the first row, and he's got a gun." And so the manager said to the usher, "Don't piss him off." I thought, all right, this is going to be a good screening. So anyway, what happened was they always ask people to fill out these questionnaires at the end, and everybody hated the musical approach because all these kids had gotten used to that song, you know, from the Mortal Kombat game. Mortal Kombat, right? You know, that thing.
It wasn't there.
To the techno music, and, you know, that's what they were used to when they played the game. So the next morning, we had a big summit, and that night, I sat down and came up with this concept called Techno Taiko Orko. And what that means is the techno is, of course, using the techno music as sort of the core of, you know, of the score. And then the taiko part of it, these big old Japanese drums called taiko drums, and using Asian drums and Asian flutes, you know, and those ethnic instruments. And then the last element, the orko, is like orchestra. And so it wasn't just any kind of orchestra. I called it my testosterone orchestra because I didn't want any treble clef instruments. In other words, no violins, no flutes, nothing that was high pitch.
Right.
Just all this low, beefy.
Like
low
beefy
things.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was sort of the concept, and the film company loved it, and that's how that sound came about.
Move on to the Austin Powers movies, you know, which are great because they so well approximate that John Barry and Monty Norman scoring style from the Bond movies.
Yeah.
But there's just something just a little bit off, you know, in those movies. You know, is there a specific dynamic working there and writing music for comedy. And, you know, I mean, you know, you obviously have a good sense of humor. I imagine, you know, that comes to the fore in a lot of ways.
Well, that's true. And, you know, that's one of the, I think, important things about being able to write for comedy is to understand humor. But working with Mike Myers, he's really a comic genius. And I learned so much about writing for comedy just from working with him. Because most of the time in those movies, the music is like the straight man, you know, in a comedy duo.
Right. Yeah, I noticed that rewatching them, you know. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, so the music kind of plays it straight, so that Dr. Evil is even funnier, and so that Austin Powers is even funnier, because they don't realize how ridiculous they are. And so
but it's not entirely straight, you know. It's not entirely straight.
No,
there's just
exactly.
Like a couple of things off in it. You know?
That's right. There's always a wink in it somewhere. But,
yeah.
What I tried to do is put myself inside Dr. Evil's head and say to myself, okay, what kind of music would Dr. Evil like to hear at this point in the film? You know?
Right.
And what kind of music would Austin Powers like to hear while he's being, you know, Austin Powers? And so
mm-hmm.
I tried to let that kind of influence what I was writing. And then the whole idea of comic timing is so important. You know, it's like where you stop the music before the funny thing happens. You know, there's he would run into something, and I would play the music up to the point and stop just before he ran into it, so there would be this little pause prior to the sound of him hitting that whatever he ran into, and it made it funnier.
Yeah, it really you know, it's one of those things that you don't realize is happening as a viewer or whatever,
right.
And you really
That's true.
You know. You really have to go back and really, like, you know, dissect it, you know. One of the things I'm interested in the Austin Powers movie is the collaboration, and in all your movies, between the composer and the music supervisor, since source music is so integral to movies nowadays,
yeah.
And in those movies, too. I'm specifically thinking about the present-day tracks used, like Madonna's Beautiful Stranger, and along with adapted tracks like the Quincy Jones' Soul Bossa Nova and Tommy James' Dragging the Line and so many. Can you take us through the dynamics of that collaboration?
Well, in terms of the songs that were the Soul Bossa Nova, came about because it was recorded in 1962 by Quincy Jones, and it was a theme song to a television show in Canada, some game show, where Mike Myers grew up. And so he sort of knew, he had that melody in the back of his head, you know, for all that time. And when he started coming up with this Austin Powers character, that was a piece of music he used to play over and over again for himself, you know, to get into the character. So by the time they hired me to score the film, that was already in place as a piece of music that they wanted to use. So my job at that point became to take Quincy's original recording and to make to reproduce it, you know, re-record it and make it work in a cinematic way for the whole film. And that was great. I didn't really get to collaborate with Quincy on there other than, you know, by telephone and I met him at one point when we both were on the set for the Goldmember, the last Austin Powers movie. But that's sort of the way I worked in collaboration with him on that. But the songs that you mentioned, I really had no input on at all. Those were decisions made by the director and by Mike Myers and the music supervisor. They, you know, went after the songs of the period that they thought would really work great. What I did have to make sure of, though, is that if I had a piece of music that was coming into the song or going out of the song, that it was either in the same key as the song, so it would sound, you know, like it was of the same piece of music or of the same tempo. Sometimes I had to try to recreate the sound of that record for a period of time so that it wouldn't end so abruptly, you know, how records end differently than you want them to in the movies.
Exactly, yeah. So you kind of have to be in sort of like a little bit of a DJ there, too. So that's
yeah, that's true. That's true.
You know, let me ask you, you know, there's so many movies I want to ask you about. John Waters' A Dirty Shame, which is a great score, and so unusual, and then Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee and so forth,
yeah.
which was, you know, incredibly different for you, but not so incredibly that you couldn't recognize, you know, what you were doing there and that it was you. You know, I want to ask you, you know, what is the role of film music in creating, you know, just tell me, you know, what is the role of film music in creating the emotional landscape of a film? And is there a line that can be crossed when the music is giving you too much information about how a viewer should be feeling at any certain moment?
Yeah, well, to answer your second question first, yes, there is a line that can be crossed where you suddenly become aware as a audience member that you're being manipulated, you know? And that's when the audience becomes aware of the music manipulating them, that's the point you've gone too far, because you don't want the audience to even notice what the music is doing to them. You know, it's almost supposed to be subliminal. And so to answer your first part of the question, yeah, definitely one of the main jobs of film music is to underscore the emotions within a scene, yeah, and within the movie. In fact, that's where the word scoring comes from. You know, to underscore something in writing is to draw a line under it, and that means you're emphasizing whatever that word is.
I never thought about that, yeah.
Yeah, that's where scoring comes from. To underscore a scene means that you're drawing this emotional line under this scene to emphasize the emotions that are within that scene. And so, yeah, that's the emotional landscape of the film. And a really good, I think, composer-director combination, find ways of doing that are so natural that the audience is just unaware. All they know is that they're feeling a certain way at that moment in the film. And, you know, they really can't pinpoint exactly why they're feeling that way.
Mm. The way we always like to conclude our interviews with each of the composers is to ask each composer, if you had to pick three film scores, you know, other than your own, and I'd be curious to know also what are your own favorite of your own scores, too, because you've done so many. So, I'd prefer to hear, you know, two parts to this question, this two-part answer here. But if you had three film scores other than your own to recommend as essential listening to movie fans, what would they be?
Most recently, it would be Michael Dana's amazing score to Life of Pi, the new movie that just came out. It's just,
he's probably going to win the Oscar for that, you know.
I hope he does. I hope he does. He's the real deal, and that's one of my most favorite recent scores of all time. In terms of older scores, I love the score to Citizen Kane. You know, which
right.
is an amazing Bernard score.
Herman.
Yeah, exactly, and almost anything of his, really.
Yeah.
But then, you know, then in the middle, you have people like Jerry Goldsmith with Basic Instinct, and then you also have, and all, you know, his great Chinatown stuff. But also you have people like Henry Mancini. Charade is just one of these amazing, you know, it's really hard to make, to choose out of all the scores that there are. But
I know, and there's so many different kinds. I mean, we're inside the K's for the for Shaft and
well, exactly. Man, you know, that is so true. I listened to that score so much when I was doing Austin Powers, especially the last Austin Powers.
Oh,
but anyway, yeah, those I think are some of my favorites. You know, of other people, and then of mine, I would say that. most recently would probably be, I don't know, but Bury My Heart in Wounded Knee is one of my favorites of mine because it was a subject that I really felt emotionally connected to, and HBO allowed me to use a Native American flute player named John Two Hawks on the score, and he brought a real sense of authenticity and spiritual beauty to it that's stunning. And then, strangely enough, the John Waters Dirty Shame score is one of my favorites.
That score is crazy. That score is crazy. It's got it's so totally many crazy. Elements going on in it. It's nutty.
I told John, I said, I want it to be rockabilly meets Catholic liturgical music meets Ema Sumac. And he said, go for it.
I'm sure that appealed to him.
exactly. And I don't know. I really liked the score to all the Austin Powers stuff. But I think my favorite one of those three scores is probably the last one because everybody had the budget they needed by then. I got to use a choir, and Mike Myers got sharks with laser beams attached to their foreheads. So.
Well, I know you said that you hope that when you're at the end of your career that your last score will be your favorite of everything that you've done. And well, I hope that your career is shooting right on forth, right on.
Well, thank you. You know, and as a matter of fact, I'm speaking to you now from Boston. Where I've taken over as the chair of the film scoring department at Berklee College of Music. And I've kept my house and studio in L.A., and I'm going to be going back and forth to do projects, you know. But over the last 10 or 12 years at the Sundance Composers Lab, I've been working a lot with young composers. And when they notified me from here that this was a position that was opening up, I really saw it as a great opportunity. So I just survived my first blizzard.
Well,
this ain't California, I tell you.
That's it for this episode of Movie Geeks United's The Art of the Score. We close tonight's show with a selection from Mr. Clinton's work on Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee.